Retina Rounds, podcast number 22. Leadership in retina can take many forms, including scientific research, education, involvement in professional societies, and advocacy efforts. If you want to be a leader, how can you set yourself up for success? In today's podcast, Retina Rounds is thrilled to welcome Dr. Michael Klufas, Associate Professor of Ophthalmology at Jefferson Medical College and a vitreoretinal faculty member at the world-renowned Wills Eye Hospital. Dr. Klufas talks about how he transitioned into a role as a junior faculty member and how he was able to take advantage of opportunities to grow into a rising leader in our field. He provides valuable pearls for any retina specialist wanting to contribute to the advancement of our field. Let's check it out.
Okay, welcome everybody to the Retina Rounds Weekly Podcast. Today we've got a real treat, Dr. Michael Klufas from Mid-Atlantic Retina, Wills Eye Hospital. Michael's well known to us, and he's been sharing his surgical videos with us this week, which are fantastic. And Michael's not only a leader in surgical innovation, but he's a clinical trialist and has a history of being a translational scientist. And we've known Michael for a long time, and I think you'll find this to be a really fun podcast to engage with. So, Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Steve, and looking forward to this meeting, and glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great. So tell us a little bit about your background, Michael. Where'd you grow up? How'd you go into medicine? Where'd you train?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up on the East Coast, definitely East Coaster. So I know it's well known to you guys during fellowship time. It was awesome being in California then, but definitely East Coast blood. I remember, you know, at UCLA, Brad DeStrasma, he was like, well, you know, people from the East Coast, they ask, where'd you go to school? And people on the West Coast, they ask, what do you like to do? And I think that really summed it up a little bit. But East Coaster at heart, grew up in Connecticut. My parents still live there. I'm visiting my brother here in San Francisco, who's a Mohs surgeon. But the reason I'm here with another sibling, too, is he's about to move back to the East Coast and be a Mohs surgeon there with his wife and his kids. So I'll track him back east eventually. I did school on undergrad and then med school. I was in New York City for 10 years, did residency there too. It was a great time. And then was fortunate to get to have some time at Jules Stein and, you know, really saw an eye mecca out there. And I remember being in the office with Buzz Krieger too. I said, hey, I really like California and UCLA. And this is like a great spot. I feel really happy. And, you know, wouldn't it be great to work here? And he's like, yeah, we love you, Mike. You know, it's great. But he's like, Mid-Atlantic, Wills Eye sounds like a really good opportunity for you if that can work out. And he's like, yeah, you like being in California and fellowship's such an exciting time. But he's like, working at UCLA could be a little tough. And he's like, you just like the process of being fellowship and it's being exciting. That doesn't mean you want necessarily have to work there. And I think that was really good advice that probably took a really seasoned pro like Buzz to give to make the right choice and head back east. And it ended up working out really well for me. Obviously, I've been here almost 9-10 years at Wills.
I think you're wrong about that. I think you've been there for like 20 minutes.
20 minutes. Yeah, I like to joke with my patients. I didn't have any gray hairs when I started. Now I got some. But some of those patients stay the same age or they don't look much older, but I think I aged a little bit, but in a good way.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Buzz had an incredible way of, well, first philosophically, Buzz taught me and I really adhered to this throughout my time there to help people figure out what they want to do and then support what their fit is, their perceived fit in the world is, not let them try and please us. So many of our fellows are amazed and enamored with what we do in the program that we lead, and then they want to please us and be part of it. And it's hard to find someone, and Buzz was this person, who could help someone discern between what their true heartfelt needs and desires are and help them fit their career choice into that goal rather than fit it into what they perceive we might want them to do or what they're enjoying in fellowship. There's no question that the fellows walk with the gods. You do so much amazing stuff as a fellow in all programs, but really at that program in particular. And it's easy to become enamored with that. And Buzz really had the ability, and I think he helped you a lot. And you were really fortunate because you hit, you know, sort of the grand slam You knew you wanted to go back to the East Coast. Your families were there. You knew that you wanted to go to the best possible retina group you could be in, best possible, and you got both. You got your dream on two fronts. You got your geolocation perfect, and you're joined probably, arguably the best or one of the very best retina groups in the world. So tell us about what it was like applying to the Wills faculty, and then the sacrifices you had to make early on to make sense to them and to make yourself work. I remember you didn't initially have much time in the mothership in Philly. You had to do a lot of work in the periphery, but you've since become so integral to that group. Tell us about that process a little bit, because a lot of our listeners, are not just domestic retina players, but also and trainees, but also internationally. It's everybody has to make sacrifices when they go into a big group. Tell us about your journey there.
I think a lot of things in life are timing and a little luck. I mean, it's always good to have, skills. Like, I'm just thinking back. I remember when looking at fellowships, Charlie Mango, he was like, "Look, like, there's places you can go and you can write papers." He's like, "You can go to UCLA and, you're going to try to jump higher. Like, how high can you jump?" And, when you have a job, or a selection or a process for jobs, you definitely have a choice finally. And I'm thinking of one of my fellows. He went to like Harvard Med School, like great residency, and then was at Wills. And he was like an early Bitcoin investor, smart guy. And he tells me, we're starting a case on a prisoner at Wills at like 9 p.m. at night. And he's like, I don't want to do your job. He's like, I want a job where I can work 4 days a week. And so he sought that out, and he got it. So I think it's always important to really assess your priorities at that point. When I was finishing up at UCLA, or 1 year into your fellowship, I said, like, look, like, I'm not done yet. I want to jump higher. And so I think the opportunity at Mid-Atlantic Wills Eye was one of those. I remember being at JP Hubschman's house, and Arnon Sivalingam called. He's like, "I think we may have a job here for you," and set up the interview and went from there. I think any big eye place or any big business or center, you definitely got to put your time in, and that's the reality. So I had to prove myself there. I think that can take anywhere from 6 months to longer. People don't really know you. They didn't train you. They don't like know you from their own program, and that's definitely I wouldn't take that as a negative, because you're interjecting another bloodline into the training for the fellows and techniques, etc. But people will definitely not necessarily be skeptical of you, but they just don't know you yet, and so it's hard to establish that trust. But if you're doing good quality work, I was living a little further away from Wills, but if there was a meeting at 6:30 in the morning, I might have had to drive 45 minutes there to go to the meeting and 45 minutes back to my clinic. But I did it, and I think people were a little surprised because they didn't know what expectation to have. But at the
But
same
Michael, one thing that you've never been accused of being is lazy. And we have a long, UCLA, we had a long relationship with the Wills going back to the Tasman days. In fact, it's a funny story. I remember getting a phone call from Dr. Tasman, and he was none too happy with me because one of our residents who had matched into the fellowship, retina fellowship at Wills, withdrew at the last minute, like the week before. And I think what happened was his wife told him, "If you go, I'm not going." And they had a young baby, and he just couldn't go. And Dr. Tasman was none too pleased with that. And he called me, and I had no place to take the phone call. And that was the genesis of getting the phones in the back hallway. Dr. Strassman looked at me and said, "What are you so bothered by?" And I said, "Well, Dr. Tasman's yelling at me, and I don't have anywhere to listen to it." And he said, "Well, let's put a phone right here." And so that's how we got the phones in the back hallway at the retina division. But we put a lot of people into the Wills program. If you think about Pitcher, Rahimi, Alan Chang, just they understand who we are, and they understand that when I tell them that this person is going to not be outworked, they have reason to believe it. And you've lived up to that, and your quality is super high, your innovation is super high. But this idea of really putting in the time there, how did you dovetail your inner drive to innovate with such a well-oiled machine?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of opportunities. One stark difference between UCLA and Whale's Eye is UCLA, like what Jean-Pierre Hofstra was doing, able to walk across the street to work with engineers. It's a whole sort of incubator or campus that's readily available in one space. One thing with Wheel's Eye, they do have relationships with Jefferson and like Drexel Engineering, but it's not like one large campus, really isolated eye hospital, which is great for like clinical research trials. But say, hey, you want to go use a 3D printer, it's not quite as accessible, but we're working on things like that to foster that kind of innovation. But I think having the opportunity to work with trainees, multi-specialty divisions in one center, doing combination surgeries, or like some of these surgeries like you've obviously done, involve like a PK and a cornea surgeon, maybe even a oculoplastics. They just really can't be done in many places in the US. And so, participating in those things, even if they're late at night, it drives all these things, builds your skills, and there's nothing you can't handle. I think, we had a trainee too. She was interviewing with us, and she was really into sports. And I said, look, I've been here maybe like 5, 6 years, and I didn't really know what to expect. But I was like, you want to play, you don't want to play like minor league. You want to play MLB. We're training you here for the Olympics, and not only for the Olympics, but to try to win the gold medal. And I think that's where, it all starts. If you're trying to excel in something and be a master of your craft, then a lot of these opportunities can open up to you. And the other thing is, you come out really motivated from fellowship. It takes time to really see where the shortcomings are in our standard of care sometimes. We know how to do a lot of those things coming out of fellowship, and those get better over time. But to really see where the rubber hits the road, where there's a problem. Like, I remember the first time I got to go to valvulotomy, and I was trying to present a clinically relevant topic, and one of them was like silicone IOLs that get the droplets adherent to them. And I tried a lot of different things, using the VFC with the 18 gauge catheter. I used Vitesse, the ultrasound that actually helps break it up. A couple other techniques, and just presented that. And it's a clinically relevant problem, but you had to do a lot of PVR cases and find these either crystal lenses or silicone IOLs to like notice that kind of problem and make a meaningful contribution.
Well, if you probably don't remember in fellowship, I taught you the easy way to fix that, which is take out the IOL.
Yes, yeah, that's always an option too. They don't like to do that at Wills too much,
Yeah.
but it probably would benefit.
And so one of the things that I admire about Wells is the diversity and excellence of the leadership, meaning you've got a group of people in Mid-Atlantic, and you're sort of becoming one of them now. And we want to sort of find out about how you've transitioned into this leadership role. But you've got fantastic leaders there. Let's just start at the top and talk about Julia Haller for a minute. Julia is one of my favorite people and one of my favorite leaders in ophthalmology, not just for her clinical expertise, but for her charisma and diplomacy and vision, strategy, tactics, outlook. Talk to me about what it's been like interacting with and working for Julia.
Oh yeah, she's amazing. I mean, obviously really well-known retina specialist as well, so in our field. It's one of those things that sometimes you need someone like a special sauce to make it all happen, and she's got that charisma, the people skills, also surgical skills, to put everything together. She just was named the CEO of Wills Eye Hospital as well, in addition to her role as the ophthalmologist in chief. So it's just been really helpful. I mean, I remember things like other places may have shied away from, for instance, Argus surgery. It's not with us anymore, but I did maybe five of those. And other places may not have afforded me the opportunity because this is not like a financially good procedure. But hey, we're Wills. We want to make this happen. Like, train Mike, let him do the implants and go from there. So, I mean, even little things of support like that are amazing, giving us access to have, funding for extramural research with fellows. Like, it wasn't my initial project, but like David Chu had worked on a project where he put a little microsensor in the shield to study postoperative positioning. And we had funds to do something like that that might not otherwise be possible. Patients don't position no matter what we tell them. we found, but little things like that just make, I think, a huge difference to support the faculty and really have the best and brightest there, and take really good care of patients clinically first, and then try to push the research. We're trying to make wills more conducive to research. As you know, many of these centers are production driven, regardless of whether it's academic or private. We do need to support that innovation as well, because even though we have those pressures, it's finding that balance. And I think Dr. Haller and others there are really trying to foster that for the next generation, so wills can go
Well,
up.
that's a great comment, and another group of real leaders there. The whole group is excellent, but I would single out Carl and Alan as remarkable clinical trialists and industry specialists. So, Alan Hull, Carl Regillo, just amazing clinical trialists and innovative thinkers. And what's it been like to work with them, and how much do you interact with them now that you're sort of establishing your own space there?
Oh yeah, I mean, we're friends and colleagues, different generations, different points. But one really remarkable thing about them is they've just been through it for a couple of decades. So I think they know when they can help you the most, whether that's something small like giving you an opportunity to speak somewhere, help create treatment guidelines for a society, applying to things like Retina Society and the such, and supporting you for things like that. Presentations as well, and they have the sort of experience to, I think, identify people who are interested, and they're like you and Buzz and everyone. Like, if you just want to go practice at Mid-Atlantic and see patients, like, that's fine too. Not everyone has to go to the meetings and do research, but if you show that initiative and drive, I think they're able to help you and give you opportunity. Even something as simple like a lot of trials come through and we probably select 10%, but they're too busy for one. Like, hey, Mike's here, he's seeing patients, he's busy, he's interested in clinical trials, like maybe you could be PI for this project. And gosh, like I got a Stargardt's study early on when I started here in 2016, and the study's closed, but there's still like the readout to happen. So these things happen over a long time, and I think you also got a take what you can get in the beginning. You may not have the best opportunity, but you have to establish yourself. And so I took all the little things really seriously, and they've paid good dividends for me and my patients long term. But once again, going back to that theme, just clinical excellence and doing it to the best of your ability, I think that is something that's very, very important. And you can't be faulted for that by patients or administrators and stuff like that, as long as it's going back to that. I think one lesson I learned early on is you never want to make anything, you don't like something or something's not perfect, you never want to make it about yourself. You want it to be better for your patients or better for the group, better for the whole. It's much more accepted that way if you aren't happy with the situation, versus like, oh, hey, I really don't like this OCT at this clinic, and I can't tell if it's like, macular edema or subretinal fluid. Now you got to make things work depending on the situation, and they often get better. But that's another thing, is it may not get better on your schedule. Like large practices, institutions, like we people in general want things to happen on their schedule, but it's not on your schedule in reality. It's going to be on the practice's schedule or the institution's schedule, and it can happen sooner or later. For me in our group too, like Joe McGuire had passed away, so that was very sad, and he was a consummate clinician. I think he may have worked with you a little bit at Moorfields or trained around the same time. And he was an advocate for me, not really knowing him that well, but then he became ill with recurrent cancer, and that created opportunity for me probably sooner than otherwise would have happened. So it's not lost on me when I see other things going on. And I try to tell the younger people too, like, that this is the reality. And same thing happens with fellows trying to get a job. If there's a lot of geographic restrictions, either due to personal preference or a spouse, you might have to wait like 1, 2, 3 years for a job. And then it's sort of advising like, where's the best intermediary position for you till you get where you want to go? Because it will happen. It's just a matter of time, I think, in a lot of situations.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. And The other leaders that I'm really enamored with at Wills are the educators. So Arnon and Rich and others are really doing a great job and have always done a great job. And my perception of who's running the fellowship and who's running the research is probably outdated, but these guys are great role models. And so what have you taken away from, I know you're really involved with getting increasingly involved with the fellowship and the residency and so on. So talk to me a little bit about what you've taken away from working with the really great educators there.
I think it's just vastly different being a fellow and then training fellows. There's so many different demands, like just ultimate respect for any attending at an academic institute or fellowship training program that's doing a good job with trainees, whether they're observing or being involved in the surgery, or you're balancing giving that patient the best clinical outcome in these vision-threatening surgeries, teaching the next generation. But I think you got to try to make it better, and every fellow is different. I think it's very great to have a fellow where you come in and you got a smile on your face, and there's not going to be like a tremor or something else, and everything goes smooth. That's not a hard fellow to educate. They have some natural talent. They're very directable. But now our fellowship has grown from three when I was here initially to 4 a year. Why is that? Well, we had, 1,200, 1,500 uncovered surgeries, so the volume was there. But the reality is, like, a lot of people want to take vacation. I didn't take any vacation during my UCLA fellowship, or like 3 days my daughter was born. But it's a different generation now, and not in a bad way, but we have to be adaptable to that. But that doesn't mean that, for instance, for me in the operating room, like, if we're finishing up a buckle at 7 p.m. and you can't tie a knot, like, that's a problem. Like, you can practice this on the couch at home. Like, you got to tie a knot square. Like, this is like a basic expectation. And so things like that, I think can be
Just
rectified.
for our audience, that's Dr. Michael Kloufos of the Wills Eye Institute talking about putting in scleral buckles. You don't hear that from every Wills attending. Sorry, carry on.
So I think surgical education is very hard, and it varies a lot per what each fellow needs. But and the thing is, at the end of the day, there's going to be different levels of surgical skills and acumen, and that's neither good nor bad, but we got to have basic competence. We have like an IC at Wills, like Colin McCannell at UCLA had made us do several of those modules before we go to the operating room at Harbor UCLA. I think that's very helpful. Some people are like, oh, you have lots of patients here. Do I need to do those things? Like, of course you do, because you want to,
Well, it's a human being under the drape. Here's a question that
exactly.
here's our question that our listeners want to hear. What are you guys looking for in fellowship candidates at Wills? What's the secret sauce? There are a lot of residents are listening to these podcasts and they want to know how this is going to help them. Wills is one of the sought after vitreoretinal fellowships. What are you looking for, meaning you, the group at Wills, in a candidate? What's the emphasis? Table stakes are great grades, great education, good centers, good recommendations. But what are you looking for? What there are 100 of those every year. So what are you looking for?
Yeah, I think I think for us, one very key point is, and I underestimated this probably coming out of fellowship too, but you realize the importance of teamwork and a cohesive partnership with your colleagues. Like, like thinking of our group, like, I think coming out of fellowship, you hear, oh, I'm going to join a partnership, and I kind of had the impression that that would be like you guys are like barbecuing on the weekend and being best friends. And that's not necessary, but you have to have a professional and also trusting relationship with your partners. You don't need to be best friends. You can if you wish. And sometimes it's probably better not to be so cohesive because there's business and pleasure. But you definitely need professionalism, courtesy, respect, I think, for others. People get animated, bite your tongue. What's going to happen if you say something bad? It's just going to create like bad blood, and it trickles down to patients too. Like, patients have problems from some of the things we do, not our intent, but if a doctor is sort of having a bad day all the time, and the patients sense that, they're nervous, et cetera, it creates a lot more problems. So I think.
So you're selecting for fellows, play nice in the sandbox, good professional interpersonal skills. What else? Those are great points.
Yeah, I think also, basic competency in the OR. I don't need someone who can complete a scleral buckle, but what we're just talking, if you cannot tie a knot, this is a problem because that's something that can be like easily rectified. You don't have to have the best hands, but that's like a lack of preparation. I mean, you'd be surprised that there are residencies where, they haven't done a lot of surgery and or like it's just not happening or they've skirted by. And I think because of our surgical volume, we need those basics there to start so we can teach you. So it sounds crazy to say that, but you can get candidates who, have been said to be the best surgeon, but if you can't tie a tenonylon nylon or seminal vicryl, it's a deficiency, I would say. So that's something you can practice on the couch at home. You don't even need a wet lab, which are ubiquitous these days. So I think, and it would be better to have like good phaco skills, et cetera, because all that microsurgery builds upon itself. And I tell the candidates too, I'm like, surgery for most is a learned skill over time. There are some fellows who are just amazing out the gate and can peel and stuff like that. I'd say that's more a rarity, and they may have a special talent or just the way their mind functions. But most of us learn surgery, and so that's I tell them, look, you're going to either learn during a fellowship, or if you don't learn here, you're going to learn the first 4 years of attendinghood. I think you're better off learning here. And I remember from I think Pradeep in the OR too. Or Dr. Hupschman, they would say, like, look, like we can go let you mess around in a diabetic by yourself, but if you listen to me and like learn the techniques, you're gonna learn a lot quicker. And that's the reality of the situation. But for me, surgery like didn't come that easy, I would say. But that's not a bad thing. You just gotta be committed to learn something and learn something new. And that kind of goes back to all the themes we've been talking about.
Well, I disagree respectfully. You were very good surgically from the beginning in the sense that you took instruction very well. You didn't disregard instruction ever. And you're very good dexterity, very good control, very poised. What I think you grew into was understanding why we were doing things and getting comfortable with the things that we were doing that we couldn't necessarily explain why they worked perfectly. You are a highly rational and concrete person, and there's an art in surgery, and you grew into that. So everybody's got something they grow into, but you were gifted from the beginning surgically. So don't sell yourself short. Or maybe I never told you that, so I'm just telling you that now. Certainly, it's certainly what I told the people at Wills when they took you, and I don't think there's buyer's remorse there. I think they're very happy.
Thanks. That's a great compliment. And then, yeah, just going on the fellows too. I think, the academic pursuits, like we do want people to, there's many different ways I think people can be relevant after a fellowship. That could be being an ASRS and presenting. That could be involved in local or national ophthalmologic societies where there's all these scope battles and, different encroachments upon, ophthalmic surgeons. That could be doing research and going on to get a K award. But I think having that third pursuit, professionalism, surgical excellence, clinical excellence, those obviously come first. But, we do want fellows to be relevant. And we're perfectly happy for someone to go out and just practice somewhere like a good, competent, or more than competent surgeon who provides excellent clinical care. But sometimes we have yearly meetings for Arch McNamara, and we invite fellows back to give talks, even if that's at Wills and sort of being part of the Wills family, they like to call it. And that's being relevant too. But I think the notion of having all this training and knowledge and giving back in some way is something like we like to ideally have a fellow have or have the desire to have, depending on their personal and professional commitments after a fellowship
Well,
as
let's
well.
talk about this idea that you're talking about right now. It's very similar to the way to our philosophy, and you want people to be leaders and contributors in whatever realm they choose to work in, whether it's academic, small practice, big practice, private equity, whatever it is. And I think that's the right outlook. How do you counsel, what do you, when the fellows come to you and they're looking at where they can go or where they can't go or how to get a job, what are the first few things that you're telling fellows to assess about positions as they're looking for their first step in their career?
Yeah, great question. I always recommend, well, the first thing I say, just from my experience, I said I cast a wide geographic net, maybe like too large. And
Yeah, because you took the tri-state area or what? I'm kidding.
no, I mean, I looked at
I'm
jobs.
kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm teasing you.
No, but like I got on a plane and a job to West Virginia. I thought like, wow, this would be a great place to start clinical trials, and it would have been. And I think my wife, we could have made it work. But it was a little bit out of the geographic strike zone. For instance, another good thing that happened, like I started talking to practice in El Paso, and my wife's like, I'm not going to get on a plane to El Paso. The guys are calling. I'm like, look, I'm not going to lead you on. Like my wife's not coming to this area. So, it's just a good example, like, see
So you
what's
got the geography for fellow results, but what are you telling Paige? You're telling the fellows geography, what else?
Well, geography first. You obviously want to be happy. I say, look, like if you are more geographically open, you may have like a shorter track to partnership, higher starting pay, but you don't want to be in a place that you're unhappy ultimately, because that's going to cost you a lot more than all those benefits. I always recommend a visit. I say, look, like see where you're going to be going, and ideally go to that clinic or practice. If I say, look, if in your gut it doesn't feel right, or there's something being hidden, or it doesn't look good, your gut is probably right. Don't try to convince yourself otherwise. Probably move on, because there's probably something there. If something doesn't feel right and you have good intuition, it probably isn't. So I always say, trust your gut. There is definitely this notion too, if there's been many people in that position and they constantly leave, I've seen that theme recur. Now being an attending to and practices in the area, there's something wrong with that position, whether it's people in the practice, the finances, or location is undesirable. So I'm always cautious of those as well. PE versus non-PE, I present it as there's positive and negatives. Look, you don't typically have to do a buy-in for PE. You're going to get a higher starting salary. Probably the peak is a lot less, but if finances are not your number of priority and that's the job available in the area, like there's nothing wrong with pursuing that position, although there is sort of a negative connotation, I think, among the younger generation about it. But the buy-ins can be very long too. So I'm not saying that's not a good deal, but you have to be prepared to invest in that business over a long period of time. And no one can predict the future, so typically, I say to them, like, things will probably be the same for 3 to 5 years, but if it's an 8-year buy-in, like, who knows what it's going to be like at that time. And same thing, risk of private equity acquisitions. There's definitely been a couple of fellows who I met a fellow who signed a contract with a group, and they actively had said, like, look, we are looking at private equity. And then they were very surprised a year later when they sold to private equity, and they had disclosed it to them when they signed the contract that we are looking. But I think it's still shocking, and you don't have the experience in business. And those are kind of like a lot of the more business-minded things that we don't get a lot of exposure to.
We've seen a lot of our fellows go through that as well, and I know you have too, where they go to a practice, it transitions to private equity, they're up in arms, and a year or two or three later, they're still pretty happy. We've seen some switch, but most of them stick it out, and most of them are pretty happy, particularly if it's one of the really good private equity groups. With good doctors running the show, in terms of quality of care and independence quotient and so on. So, Michael, that's really interesting, the things that you share with them. Let's talk about, besides the hard work and going the extra mile and the quality, what was it that has allowed you? You've really had a meteoric trajectory, with industry-based clinical trials. A lot of young investigators are interested in getting more involved in clinical trials. So you've mentioned that you had supportive senior people in the practice that helped you get in there. You've mentioned that you've taken advantage of the opportunities by saying yes, by delivering quality patients in, quality patients out, good data, good recruitment, good completion, quality data. You do a great job at the podium. What is it that you think you would tell a junior faculty or a junior partner somewhere who wants to get into clinical trials and maybe doesn't have the access that you had automatically at Wills? to just really, obviously you have to hit all those performance metrics. You can't treat this secondarily, but how would you recommend to people to consider getting involved in clinical trials? And do you enjoy it? Do you recommend it?
Yeah, no, I think there are a couple big factors. I think it's a very interesting curve. The more senior you get in the practice, obviously you accumulate a lot of injection patients, even if they're at long intervals, and therefore you have less new patient slots. So many of the trials are treatment naive rather than existing treatment. So, when you're starting out, like it may be beneficial to go to several clinics where you have more new patients because that does create the opportunity to potentially recruit if that's the right therapy. I think just as important as that is, we look at a lot of trials, but if it's not a good trial for our patients, then it's going to be hard to recruit for. So you have to really look at the study designs because you are discussing with a patient, like, look, you can go into standard of care, which we have really great treatments for, or we can do this. And then you have to look at the control arm. Things like, like port delivery system too, like those trials were really well designed. Like the patient could be randomized to injections, but they will transition to the port at, 12 months. So like, when you're talking to them, you're like, you will get the port, whether you get it up front or a year from now, you will receive it. That's a like a good design if that's the goal for like a durability type study. But I think new patient visits are very important because if you don't have those new patients, you don't really have the opportunity to recruit. So, if
Well,
you're
that's a great tip for our listeners. So, trying to set yourself up in a situation where you're seeing enough new patients that you can enroll in treatment naive trials, regardless of the disease indication and the inclusion criteria, will set you up for success in terms of recruiting.
And that could be driving to a clinic that's an hour away, where there's just a dearth of clinicians. But most of the sponsors too are very generous with like travel support. So if it's a good thing for the patient and they're willing to travel to where you do the trials, they'll have support for that. But all these things factor in. But I think, choosing the right trials and having the opportunity. And then third is how to speak to patients about trials. Like, I mean, you're obviously an expert in this. I feel we're trying to improve this in our own fellowship because we have a large fellow clinic, but not enrolling that much in trials. But it's a you're trying to learn standard of care first, so it's a very difficult thing to integrate. But for some of these patients, a trial may be better for whatever reason, whether access or investigational product. And so it's nice to offer that to your patients to add to the treatment paradigm. And then trials too, where there's no treatment for the disease condition, like Stargardt's disease, great thing to offer to patients. So otherwise, they're coming to see you, whether a year, every 2 years, and you're like, there's nothing here.
Unmet
But
medical needs. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. All right, let's shift gears and talk about economics for a minute, an area that I really respect your opinion. What are you guys doing about this modifier controversy with injections? Explain what it is, your perception of the controversy, and how you're dealing with it.
So I think you're referring to the 25 modifier.
Correct.
Yeah,
For our
so
international listeners, they won't know what that is. So explain what the challenge is for the clinician, how we code, how we get paid, what you do versus what's allowable, and meaning what you do clinically versus how we're allowed to bill is not always aligned in the United States.
right. So basically, we're talking about billing an exam fee, which from Medicare, depending on where you are practicing, is probably anywhere from $40 to $80. At the same time, you're being paid for an injection, which is, maybe around 100, depending on the zip code, plus the practice typically would be reimbursed for the medication. So the issue is when you do an exam at the same time as an injection, you append the modifier 25 to the exam code. So you, as the physician of practice, can receive remuneration. And there are many different ways to do injections. If you are doing PRN and you're seeing the patient monthly, you would be billing 12 exams a year and deciding treatment that day. If you're doing treat and extend and the patient's stable and they have no other conditions in the other eye, there probably should be a lot more direct to injections. Now you have a patient with uveitis, geographic atrophy, in addition to wet AMD, a PVD, and everything else. There needs to be some kind of code to justify why you would examine the fellow eye or the same eyes that are receiving injections. So Personally, I believe if they're like bilateral neovascular AMD and they also have geographic atrophy, you could justify some amount of examinations per year. On the flip side, when UCLA, we did a lot of direct-to injections, and I think that works really well for stable patients. So I don't have a lot of qualms about doing direct-to injections without billing an exam code. I do an OCT, especially if the other eye is not neovascular, but I think it's a lot easier for patients too, personally. So I've never been super aggressive about billing the exams in my personal practice. Learning a lot from your clinic, actually, just the smoothness of it and the direct to injections not being dilated as such. Like it's very convenient for patients, and I think the outcomes work really well. Now, earlier on, I had mentioned this to colleagues at meetings, and some were like, "Oh no, you need to be like doing an exam every, 8 weeks or something." And it's not necessarily that you're not like looking at the eye when you're not billing an exam, but you're just not billing an exam. So I think it really comes down more to the billing than the medical management.
So you're personally not using the 25 more than 3 or 4 times a year per patient per eye type of thing?
Oh yeah, or perhaps even less. I mean, for instance, if I have a patient with unilateral neovascular AMD and they're a 10-week interval, I'll do 10 weeks direct to injection, 20 weeks eval, and so that would probably be 2 exams a year. And I'm fine with that. I mean, I
And
think,
you're looking at the OCT every time
yes,
of both eyes.
OCT every
And
time.
this is in the, for our listeners, this is in the absence of a new complaint symptom from the patient. Obviously, if Dr. Klufus's patient comes in with new floaters or flashes or field cuts or pain or injection, they're getting an exam for a legitimate new problem. But you're not scraping around looking for new problems to document to squeeze out another 25. Is that what you're saying?
No, but like if a patient does come in, and I'll instruct the intake staff, if they have new floaters and they're worse, like, hey, are they worse or not? If they're worse or there's new problem, please dilate the patient. Now, sometimes that requires a medical doctor to determine. So if they come in the room and I'm like, okay, what's going on? Like, oh, I have this problem and they haven't been dilated, I'll switch to an examination. I have no qualms doing that, especially if there is a new diagnosis. You should be compensated for an exam and what you're doing. So, you don't want to underbill and overbill. But I think as long as you're justified in your examination. Now, my understanding too is the way CMS and others have looked at these things is it depends on your peers in the region and how frequently they are doing, the 25 modifier.
I wouldn't know that, but I will tell you this. I have always been sort of a traditional programmed reinjector, at fixed intervals and not doing a lot of treat and extend, mostly because my practice was predominantly monocular patients who had lost their eye to treat and extend, their first eye to treat and extend. And so I would say north of 70% of my patients, as you recall, were monocular, a lot of them physicians. And so we were just sort of programmed reinjecting. And I'm a big believer, strong advocate for frequent exams. So I am in the corner of those who do use the 25, particularly for patients who require an examination. I'm not a big believer in a 25 every time. If there's no backup for it, but if there's backup for it, these are complex eyes, complex patients, complex. So I think there's room for support here. Unfortunately, we've got this push and pull with the regulatory agencies. How is Wills? Is there a blanket recommendation in your region or at your center for how to deal with this, or are they just telling you to do what you do?
No, we don't like have any requirements for, how frequently you should inject or,
Or shouldn't. Or what about, but how about to deal with the modifier?
I
No,
think,
no recommendations.
I mean, we've had discussions and, we've just said to, the group in general, like if you are doing an exam every single visit on like every 28 days, like that would be kind of odd, like that's probably not the norm. So like why would you be doing that? Like if there is an active problem, like do it. I mean, my uveitis colleagues encounter this frequently that they are dealing with a lot of concurrent issues. And so
That's different, though.
that's
That's not
different.
a.
It's not the standard bread and butter retina. So I think, that's as far as our discussions have gone. That
So,
like,
no real recommendations for our listeners on how to deal with this. It doesn't surprise me, and there probably shouldn't be, but I was just curious to see because they're really forward thinkers at Wills, and could really drive behavior. And well, that's just fascinating. So Michael, let's switch over to innovation for a minute. What's got you most excited about new innovative or even inventions? Like, there are a lot of great drug trials, there are a lot of great device trials, but what is it about for you personally that's got you super jazzed? Do you think it's a new drug? Is it a new device? Is it AI? Is it robotics? Where are you going with your excitement?
I mean, to be honest, I'm not trying to like put you on a pedestal or anything, but your presentation at Vail with the AI mapping the eye with Horizon Surgical, I really was quite impressed by just how far it's come from what I've seen when I was training at UCLA, and I think that kind of speaks to the whole climate with AI and robotic surgery is moving at such a fast rate. So I mean, it may be different for retina, but for cataract surgery, it sounds like such a intriguing prospect to deal with this large number of patients coming through, potentially improve outcomes and provide the best care to our patients. I think it's so interesting to think that the current generation may have some qualms about robotics doing surgery, but I'm sure my generation, like we will want something automated to do our surgery. So I kind of look forward to that 10 to 20 years. I think the regulation will be fascinating. Just, I'm not sure if there are any FDA-approved AI surgeries quite yet, but I'm sure they're coming very quickly in the coming months or years. And so it'll be very interesting to see how something like the FDA regulates these things going forward. But I'm keeping close tabs on that. I think it's just super fascinating the mapping. Having just seen automated cars, it would make a lot of sense that we can map the eye and potentially improve outcomes there.
Well, Michael, let me just say thank you for your compliment on my presentation. Of course, my best presentations are always generated by actual intelligence, which means not me. So we have to give credit to Jean-Pierre Hubschman and his team at Horizon and to Aya Barzilay and TC in the engineering and vitreoretinal labs at UCLA. They are all remarkable. They're part of the ARPA-H projects. They're part of, the NEI has supported this work traditionally, and now Horizon and their partners are super. It is super exciting. I was very smart when I started this project because I asked JP to take it over, and that was the smartest thing that I ever did. And JP has taken it to places that are going to be truly impactful. And I do think, and I think I said this in an interview after the Vail meeting. This is a lot like it's not going to replace surgeons anytime soon. That's not what I'm talking about. But the truth is, you don't want to get on a commercial flight that doesn't have autopilot and radar and GPS. And we get into, we do surgery on people and we get in there and it's one surgeon and his instruments or her instruments, and that's it. There needs to be real-time integration of the instruments that already exist. That's OCT, ultrasound, high resolution imaging, all integrated and being synthesized by the AI and controlling trajectories and notifying us when there's going to be a collision, right? And notifying us when we're about to fly into a mountain or another plane or the retina or the capsule. And that's really what this is right now in the short term. It's democratizing outcomes and bringing them up to a level where everyone's operating like the 15 best cataract surgeons in the country instead of one through 2,500 or one through 25,000, however many there are. We want everybody in that top strata. It's not replacing you, it's augmenting your abilities and making sure that you're doing the best by the patient there. And I do think that's an exciting area. I'm glad to hear that you're enthusiastic about it and that it impacted you positively. So Michael, I think that it's fair to say that you are one of the rising stars in retina, and we're incredibly proud of you out here in California that you spent a little time with us before you went back and joined the Wills Group. And I'm incredibly proud of the work you're doing now and no longer treat you like a trainee. I think of you as a colleague. And in fact, I call you for advice more than you call me for advice. So it's really great to have you on the call and to watch your ascent. I know the response to your surgeries on retina rounds has been spectacular. You're a wonderful surgeon. You've got a lot to share with us, and congratulations on your career to date and being part of Wills. And thanks for sharing all this with us here at Retina Round. So great job, Michael. Thanks very, very much.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.